Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. Every day there's an opportunity for a win, just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. It's where anticipation meets instant gratification. And they're satisfying to scratch, no matter the outcome. Like the new Virginia Lottery Scratcher Colossal Cash. It's loaded with $100 to $500 prizes. Now, that's an everyday win. Drive to the nearest Virginia Lottery retail location and pick up a scratcher today. Odds of winning any prize, 1 in 3.21.
Some cars are comfy on the inside, but don't have power on the outside. And some cars have the horsepower, but none of the comfort. I used to think there weren't any cars that were the total package. But that all changed when I got my Honda SUV. It's rugged and sophisticated, and right now, Honda has deals on the entire Honda SUV lineup. CR-V, HR-V, Pilot, Passport, you name it. So if you're looking for a car that's the total package, the only place you'll find it is at your local Honda dealer. Hurry before they're all gone.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. Really interesting topic on the history of the NFL and some inflection points in rules changes and run pass balance. Joining me today for that discussion is the author of a great article we're going to point you to.
Hey, Ken. It's good to good to be on with you. I appreciate you finding the article, first of all, then having me on the show.
Well, you said you wrote this 7 years ago. It's still very pertinent in terms of how the game has changed and really catching some of these inflection points. So I happen to catch it through somebody else mentioning that running backs in the 1970s and what sometimes is referred to as the dead ball era for the NFL. It's kind of interesting that, you know, football has such a thing. And it was in the 70s, which I wouldn't have guessed, had six consecutive years where running backs led the National Football League in receptions. And three of those were Baltimore Colts players, Lydell Mitchell twice and Joe Watt.
Yeah, it's interesting when you go back in the history of the NFL. It's funny because I'll tell you the origin of this article 7 years ago. I was trying to figure out how to get back into writing a little bit. And I just started my own portfolio site. And I was interested in applying. Now, I was in high school. I was a math geek. Like, I took 2 years of calculus in high school and of course put that to work in a journalism career. And I was like, all right, well, you know, what am I interested in? I'm interested in sort of statistical analysis. And I got into a fight with a buddy of mine who, Eric Lopez is his name. And he, No. This is Eric Lopez Elo. We joke that he's the Woj of college softball. So if you ever get a chance to follow him, Eric Lopez Elo on Twitter, if you're a college softball fan. But anyway, he and I had an argument about when the NFL was more entertaining. And he argued it was back when the era of defense and running and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, that's not true. Like, the best years of the NFL in terms of TV ratings have been since the passing game has really taken off. And, you know, I saw a couple things. There was another thing on NFL films I saw about, I don't know if you saw it, but if you see it on YouTube, it's really cool. It was about the actual football. And I think Boomer Esiason helped out on it. And it was, and he like showed like how to throw different footballs from different eras of the NFL and how, yeah, it was, if you get the chance to see it on YouTube, it's really cool. I'll send you the link so that everyone can see it. And like the old footballs were basically impossible to throw. They were like, I mean, if Boomer's holding, he's like, I can't throw this thing. It's like, yeah, it's like throwing, it's like throwing an oblong medicine ball. And it progressed to the shape of the Duke football that we know and love today. And so I was like, all right, well, I have Pro Football Reference here. I'm just curious, like, how has the passing game really evolved over time? So I just grabbed the data from Pro Football Reference, and they have a table that that I actually linked to in the piece where it shows you the average offensive production of every team put together for every season, and it showed average, you know, rushing yards and average passing yards per game per team. So I just threw that into a graph, and some really interesting information came out of it. And you were talking about the period of time in the 70s when six players who were running backs actually led the NFL in receptions. This was at a time when there are kind of two eras in the NFL where the pass kind of overtook the run. Obviously, you could start out in the 1930s. The data goes back to 1932. And initially, it was basically all running. There was not a lot of passing. In fact, initially, teams averaged barely over 50 passing yards a game starting out. And then it started picked up a little bit. 1939 was the first season on record that we know of where teams averaged more passing yards per game than rushing yards per game. All right. And then, yeah.
A lot of people would be surprised it was that long ago. But then a lot of the people who know the 30s know that the Packers, for example, with Don Hutson, were way ahead of the game in terms of going to a pass-first offense. Or not a pass-first offense, but a lot of more passing.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, more pass. And you also had guys like, Sammy Ball was part of that with the Washington. And then there's sort of a steady climb in overall offensive production until about in the mid 50s. And in 1956 was actually the year that the NFL had the highest average rushing yards per game on record for each team. Is 155 rushing yards per game per team on average in a game. And passing kind of dipped toward the middle late 50s, which is kind of surprising because that's when, you had Paul Brown and the Cleveland Browns and Otto Graham coming around. But, they also had, obviously, as we know, with Jim Brown, a pretty potent rushing attack. Then you get to the early 60s. And I have no hard information to really verify this, but when you get to the 60s, there opens up a gap between passing and rushing. Rushing goes down, passing goes up. And I think the reason behind that was the AFL.
Yes.
Now, the stats I put together were only from the NFL, but I think what the coaches and the owners knew at the time is that the AFL was presenting a much more exciting brand of football that was gaining market share on the NFL, and they were passing the ball out. They said, we got to loosen up the rules a little bit on passing here and have a little bit more and open up the game a little bit more. That worked until the merger. And then when the merger happened in the late 60s, passing went down, rushing went up. And there were a couple of factors for that. First of all, you had three NFL teams move to the AFL and what became the AFC. Right. And then you also had once the AFL was essentially absorbed into the NFL kind of obviously felt that, they were the big boys in town and kind of threw their weight around and said, all this namby-pamby passing stuff is not for us. We're going to play football like real men. You know what I mean?
I don't have any specific rules that might have caused that.
No specific rule changes in particular in that part. But when we get to the actual legislation of the game starts in the late 70s. So to put things into perspective, 1977 was the last year of kind of what we call the dead ball era. And it was the last season on record where rushing outpaced passing. All right. So in 77, I believe the Cowboys won the Super Bowl that year. And it was about 144 rushing yards per game, 142 passing yards per game per team. Now, that's when the competition committee, which, at the time, Don Shula actually was on the top competition committee. And I'm sure you remember for a long time he was on that committee and did a lot to advance the game. And make it a more fan friendly experience. So in 78, there were three major rule changes that were passed. The first one that we know pretty well is we call the Mel Blount rule, which is the illegal contact
eliminated
foul.
You can't run coverage effectively.
Right. Yeah. You can't touch the receiver beyond 5 yards from the line of scrimmage after the ball was thrown. If you touch a receiver beyond that point, it's pass interference. Now, how much they've called that has always depended over the years, but that was when they first wrote that rule down because the Steelers were just mugging opponents downfield and they weren't the only ones, but they were known for that. All right. Just ask John Madden. Not as obvious, but another thing that I was surprised at when I was looking back at the history of it was Pass blockers, okay, were permitted to actually extend their arms and open their hands to block, which I had no idea that they weren't allowed to do that. But but in the past, you could only block like this. Right? You had to have your forearms out. And so guys pass block like this. Now you can get your hands out on a defender. That impeded pass rushes. That gives the quarterback more time to throw. And then another one that I think kind of got overlooked was an extra set of eyes on the officiating crew. They instituted the side judge. So now you have another pair of eyes looking at downfield contact. What happens the very next year? Steelers 35, Cowboys 31 in the Super Bowl. One of the highest scoring Super Bowls to date. At the time, it was the highest scoring it was for a long time. And you see in the graph that I put together an immediate spike over a period of about 4 or 5 years to about 1981, which was the first season where we had teams averaging per game 200 passing yards or more. And from there, there's a clear gap. Now, it's narrowed a few times, actually about twice it's really narrowed. But since then, there's been a real extension out where there's a gap almost 2-1 between passing yards a game and rushing yards, 19 yards per game.
Slow increase, a slow and gradual increase in passing yards per game, mm-hmm. and slow and gradual decrease in rushing yards per game. Although a lot of that happened by about 1990. And it's been pretty low
right.
since. I want to go back to the two rule changes, because one thing you talk about, offensive line length is one thing that's just critical at offensive tackle now. Just think, you couldn't use it before 1970.
Right.
And
yeah.
players did, but they were called for holding a fair amount for it. And there were, the holding calls were very prevalent in the game. The other thing that has been done since is allowing offensive linemen to hold the jersey inside the frame. And that's mm-hmm. something that I'm not sure exactly when that rule change was made, but it was one of the ones, that no doubt helped extend the passing lead over running during this period.
Yeah, and it's allowing offensive linemen to block actually opened up a lot of opportunities for like you said, it actually changed how the draft works when you think about it. I mean, we'd be, back in the day, obviously, arm length didn't matter, you know? Now it's one of the measurables that we look at the combine. It's funny, I remember looking at the America's Game episode from NFL Films. They talked about the Steelers, and Mel Blunt complained that, you know, that when they changed the rules and they instituted the illegal contact, well, he's like, well, that was just to keep the Steelers down, you know? And I'm like, well, no, it's actually to keep you guys from mugging receivers downfield. But it was a lot of things. Even through the decade of the 80s and into the 90s, you sort of started to see defenses catch up. Like in 89, there was a peak of 210.9 yards per game in the passing game, and then you see a little dip. And the biggest dip was around 91-92. So that's when we had some really legendary defenses in NFL history. Yeah, that Great Eagles team in 91 that didn't make the playoffs with a 10-6 record. Could you imagine? Randall Cunningham blew out his knee in the first game of the year in Green Bay. And people forget also that if it wasn't for them, we would be talking about the New Orleans Saints that year and how good a defense they were with that incredible linebacking core, Sam Mills and Ricky Jackson, and of course the great Pat Swilling, and not to mention the number of other. I mean, Washington's defense obviously was very good that year. Buffalo had a very good defense. Those two teams met in the Super Bowl, and we started to see a little bit of erosion in the television ratings too, because games were being decided. It was a lot of field goals. I remember at the time I was like, oh my gosh, field goals, field goals, field goals. We got to stop doing field goals. There were actually proposals in the rules committee in the offseason around 93 that we need to get rid of field goals. All kinds of loony things that sometimes you hear leak out of there, like, Arena Football League, uprights, like you were saying, all that kind of stuff. So, but then, again, the rules committee said, okay, let's not go crazy here. So in 93, for the 93 season, they in 1992, by the way, it was 187 yards per game. So it's 210 in 89 to 187 5 years later. So that's a really, that's a big drop in a short amount of time. Defenses were figuring things out. We were getting better athletes on defense. Illegal contact wasn't being called as much. So in 93, the first thing that happens is they shrink the play clock from 45 to 40 seconds. 94 was the big, I think the big revolution. All right. They, first of all, 2-point conversion. So we're going to open up scoring a little bit. The AFL finally wins. They moved the kickoff back to the 30-yard line. So more returns. That was the idea behind it. But then two other things. Neutral zone infraction actually became a thing. Used to be if the defense could dance all over the field and you had to sit there as an offensive lineman, you couldn't move. Well, now if they jumped into the neutral zone and then you moved into reaction to that, you know, like a normal human would, then the defense gets called for the penalty. And also the defense taking over at the spot of a missed kick actually prevented, actually resulted in a drop in the number of field goals attempted. So what happens? More teams decide to go for it. You get more offensive yards out of that.
We'll change right back to the 70s, I'm pretty sure. It might be 78, might even be 73 in terms of returning to the spot of the kick.
They changed it, and then they changed it back, and then in 94 they made it permanent. Because it was, I remember Bill Parcells was talking about this when he was at the Patriots, because he was having trouble figuring out what kicker he wanted, and eventually he, you know, dragged Matt Barr off the scrap heap once again, because he had Drew Bledsoe at the time, and he didn't want to, you know, he was concerned about, you know, oh my gosh, I got to send the kicker out there. No, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to go for it more. And that's when Bill Parcells really kind of became, you know, I mean, he was with the Giants, obviously, but became much more of a gambler after that rule change was reinstated. And then 95, actually, people forget about this one, was when they installed the radios inside the helmets for the quarterbacks. This was experimented with in the World League of American Football, if people remember, which later became NFL Europe. That initially, I remember, and you can go on YouTube and watch some of those old games, and USA Network used to televise them. And they would tap into the feeds, and you could hear the coach calling plays to the quarterback, and then the quarterback, you could hear. There's a really good, I actually had one on VHS tape. It was the second World Bowl, because there were 2 years of the World League, then it went away for 2 years, then it came back as NFL Europe. The first 2 years they had American teams mixed in with some European teams, and in the second incarnation of it was only European teams. There was a team here in Orlando. I'm based in Orlando. And Scott Mitchell, who you remember, was the quarterback.
Yep.
And you could hear his offensive coordinator and head coach was Galen Hall, who is the worked at Penn State and then also worked at Florida, I believe, and was the head coach. And you could hear him talking to their system with the Thunder. The Orlando Thunder was Galen Hall would call a number, and then Mitchell would look down at his wristband. They were among the first guys to have the wristband, the play calls on the wristband, and you'd hear Galen Hall say, "Okay, 34," and then Mitchell would call 34, and they would run out of the no huddle. Willie Davis was a receiver on that team who played for a while with the Kansas City Chiefs, and they had a couple guys who were also got cups of coffee in the NFL, like Roger Vick and Darrell Clack, and they made it all the way to the World Bowl with that system, and I've got that on YouTube as well. It's pretty interesting to see how they ran that no huddle offense.
They ran it strictly by a single number call as opposed to wisely,
right?
You know, all that. Interesting.
Yeah.
And what year would have that been that Scott Mitchell is trying to make a comeback in the World League of American Football?
This was prior to him hitting it big with Detroit. So this was the spring of 92.
Okay. So he had his cup of coffee with the Ravens in 99, went 0-2, mm-hmm. and then handed the reins over to Stoney Case and then Tony Banks.
So, yes, the illustrious Stoney Case and Tony Banks. But that was, by that time, like, Mitchell's best days were behind him. He had 1 year in Detroit where he had thrown for 4,000 yards, and Herman Moore had a big year. But prior to that, he was with the Dolphins, and he took over for Dan Marino when Dan blew out his Achilles in Cleveland. in 93. So, you know, by that time, Mitchell had had plenty of experience running an offense. And Miami almost made the playoffs that year, were it not for a catastrophic last five game run. They were 9-2, and then they went and then they lost their last five games with Steve DeBerg at quarterback because Mitchell got hurt. Yeah, that was, remember the Leon Lett game on Thanksgiving Day in the snow?
I cannot say that I recall that. I remember Leon Lett, of course, in the Super Bowl, but not
right
Leon Lett then.
Okay, so they were playing the Dolphins were playing the Cowboys in Dallas on Thanksgiving Day. It was snowing in Texas Stadium, and that was the game where Dallas had blocked Pete Stojanovic's attempt on in the final minutes and to try and win the game.
Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. Every day there's an opportunity for a win, just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. It's where anticipation meets instant gratification. And they're satisfying to scratch, no matter the outcome. Like the new Virginia Lottery Scratcher Colossal Cash. It's loaded with $100 to $500 prizes. Now, that's an everyday win. Drive to the nearest Virginia Lottery retail location and pick up a scratcher today. Odds of winning any prize, 1 in 3.21.
Introducing the Lowe's List for Innovation. While our aisles are filled with innovative products, we've selected our favorites just for you. Like the exclusive Whirlpool washer with industry-first 2-in-1 removable agitator. We love this washer because you can customize any load. And with other smart features to streamline your laundry routine, this product is a must-have for families. Shop the full Lowe's List of top picks at Lowe's.com. Lowe's, home to any budget, home to any possibility. U.S. only.
And then Leon Lett inexplicably in celebration slides into the football in the snow. Jeff Dellenbach falls on it at the 1 yard line. And of course, when that happens, it's a free ball. Mm-hmm. So Jeff Dellenbach of the Dolphins fell on it at the 1 yard line with 2 seconds to go. And Stojanovic kicked a 19 yarder to win it. So that was Leon's second spectacular blunder so on national television.
Block field goal went beyond the line of scrimmage,
right,
touched by a defensive player, touched by the blocking team a second
yep
time, made it a free ball, was recovered.
Exactly. And Stojanovic won it. So that was the Dolphins' last win that season. They were 9-2 and leading the AFC East, and they lost 5 in a row after that and missed out on the playoffs. But anyway, I know that's really far afield.
Little bit of Ravens history I want to tie to that real quick.
Okay.
The 2000 Ravens playoff game at Tennessee, they won effectively on a blocked field goal return for a touchdown by Anthony Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And you'll see, if you look at that play again, everybody on the team basically that's going back to him is going, you know, the safe sign for an umpire. Basically,
yeah,
that football alone, Mitchell catches it out of the air. Mitchell, they actually had another blocked field goal earlier in that game that Mitchell went chasing into the end zone, but he asked Rod Woodson on the sideline, can't I return those? Mm-hmm. He said, you can, but then you risk a fumble or whatever. Then second time around, sure enough,
yeah,
he was gone at the distance.
That's why you hear whenever there's a field goal, we have microphones all over the field, and every once in a while on a blocked kick, if you're lucky enough to see it, you'll hear guys yell poison, 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 which
poison
means yes,
good,
get away from the ball, it's poison, don't touch it, because of Leon Lett. Everyone was reminded of that on Thanksgiving Day in 1993. But yeah, going back to where we were before, when you see that, those kinds of rule changes and those kinds of and were really big changes that gave a better hand to the offense, right? Instead of miscommunication with plays, like the helmet, with the radio in the helmet, now he can hear directly from the offensive coordinator or the head coach, not just what play to call, but also, hey, they're playing two deep now, or they're playing one deep, or they're playing just straight man to man. You might have an opportunity for something. You can audible to this. So you're not just calling plays, you're also coaching a little bit. And I think that contributed really, really big in the early to mid 90s toward a sustained increase in passing yardage and pass production compared to the run.
It'd be easy to see how that would benefit the offense more. And to go back to the old Cowboy teams who were advanced in terms of what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point, they were alternating White and Staubach on a play-by-play basis to bring in the next play.
Right.
And before that, they'd done it with their tight ends, included Mike Ditka as one of two guys who would bring in the play. But teams were bringing in guys from the sidelines. Those plays were being called. A lot of teams had their quarterback just call the game at the line of scrimmage because
right,
that became too cumbersome. But you can easily see how just making pertinent comments about the defense would really help the quarterback in a lot of times diagnose what's going on.
Yeah, it was. You know, we don't see, and I think a lot of players, like in 91, 92, John Elway was calling his own plays. Dan Reeves allowed him to do that. And Denver had a pretty good year that year. They lost to Buffalo in the AFC Championship game in 91. But that was the first year that Elway, for example, was allowed to call his own plays. And I remember growing up, now I grew up in South Florida. I was a Dolphins fan. I'm a big New York Giants fan, as you can see, but I was also, you know, just by, you know, osmosis kind of became a Dolphins fan as well. And, you know, watching Dan Marino, we would always complain, why don't they let Marino call his own plays? Like, he knows, he can see what's going on better than anybody. If it was good enough for, you know, Johnny Unitas and good enough for John Elway, why wouldn't it be good for Dan Marino? And that was one of the things that used to drive us crazy about that, because we would see him on TV, like, you know, Gary Stevens was the offensive coordinator at the time, and he would call a play and it wouldn't work. And you'd see Marino on NBC, like, screaming at the sideline, you know, because he was a hothead anyway, right?
And it's a good look.
Yeah, but you could see him screaming. You could pretty easily read his lips through his face mask, and it was not family language, shall we say.
Interesting stuff. So a lot of inflection points in the history of the game. Any others that we didn't hit on maybe that you want to talk about?
Well, you know, we hit an all-time high in average passing yards, believe it or not, in 2015. 243.8 yards per game per team. There was a little bit of a dip in 2017, and that was kind of the season where everyone was like, oh man, this is kind of a lousy season. We had a lot of injuries to quarterbacks, but now it's back up. It's not quite as high, but it's close to the 240 range this past year, and it's pretty much steadied out. But you know, a lot of people say, oh, they don't run the ball anymore. Actually, rushing has stayed pretty consistently over about 100 to 115 yards per game for the last 30 years or so, with a few little hops and skips, but not
much less variation than
passing. Right. Much less variation in the passing. And I think what has happened is the NFL has figured out its formula for what makes for an exciting game, for what makes for a good watch. And what they've done instead is, we hear it all the time, and I'm sure you hear it all the time, Ken, is a point of emphasis this year will be calling illegal contact downfield, or a point of emphasis will be roughing the passer. Every year we always hear about that. Well, the reason why they're trying to do that, and those points of emphasis usually last through the month of September, and then they back off. But what happens is the players adjust to it. And I think what the NFL has detected is, okay, we're seeing a little bit less production. Let's tell our officials, hey, let's work a little bit more on illegal contact and pass interference. Now, this past year, people have been complaining. Defensive players have been complaining. Oh, it's too much in favor of the offense. We need to get a little bit back here. So we're seeing we saw a little bit the last couple of years on a reemphasis of offensive pass interference, particularly with push offs and things like that. They still don't call pick plays though, which they never will. Right.
Once per season or so. I mean, all the receivers know, you know, you just get in the way and then get out of the way is the key. Make that defender fear that contact, play chicken with him, then get out of the way. And it's very, very rarely called once a season.
Right. Plus, the other thing I think that people, you know, and fans in particular lose sight of, and I think we lose sight of too, is the fact that officials are making these calls in real time with their own two eyes. And it's hard to make these calls. Like, we see games all the time, you know, on TV that, you know, they replay a call or a non-call from 15 different angles in ultra, you know, 4K ultra high definition, you know, in super slow motion, you know, 100 frames a second, right? And of course, we're sitting here at home on our couch saying, you know, hey, how come he didn't see that? And I'm like, well, you try making that call in real time with your own two eyes, because the officials don't get the benefit of actually replaying every play. Now, there have been some discussions about whether or not one day we're going to have a booth official that can call down on certain plays. They haven't, as far as I know, they haven't actually instituted that just yet. They've experimented with it in the Alliance of American Football. Is that right, though, Ken?
Yeah, I like the way, I'm not actually sure about the AAF, but I like the way they have it in hockey and baseball, where it's not anybody who's in the stadium. So it's kind of like nobody to boo at, because the decision's being made in New York. The decision's being made in L.A., whatever it might be. But I kind of like that system, and I don't think that would be a bad thing at all to have an NFL oversight committee that's seeing from a third site. I don't think that would be a problem.
I think the one issue that you might have, and this is where the tech nerd comes in, okay, in my perspective, is the one issue you might have with that is latency. Like getting the live video signal back to New York or wherever, right? And then them being able to buzz an official somehow from New York all the way back in, you know, Los Angeles or Seattle or wherever, you know, those signals have to travel a long way pretty quickly. And when you're talking about, you know, 25 to 40 seconds, you know, that's not a lot of time.
It takes about there's only 2 second latency on the DirecTV feed relative to other feeds. So I'm not convinced that'd be an issue. But in any case, the format of football is better than, say, the format of basketball in terms of turning around a call. And, you know, they do it in basketball still,
right,
too. So I got to feel it would be possible. I mean, sensors in the football is something that makes a lot of sense, too, for crossing the goal line. That has not obviously happened yet. They've got a lot of things they probably could solve right now with today's technology that they just have decided, you know, we really don't want to do that just yet.
Yeah, the sensors in the football thing I was always interested in, but that's actually harder to pull off technically than I think most people think, because any part of the football can reach a given space on the field. So it's not like you just have, you know, a little GPS sensor in one side of the ball and a little GPS sensor in the other. No, you got to have that. Something has to reflect off of something all the way around. And then what happens on these really, you know, like fourth and one plays where the ball is hidden in a pile of 22 bodies? You know, I mean, what are you going to, you know, where can the sensor sense where the ball is through 22 humans with all of their metal and plastic padding? I don't know. That's a tough technical thing to kind of figure out. If they can figure it out, great, all for it. You know, I think that would be pretty cool to do, but I think that's a bigger technical challenge than I think even we might even realize.
I think to tell when the knee is down is the harder component of that. The ball, you can project the size of the ball if you have both tips, so you can project where the other edge of the football is. And you know, the NFL data that they distribute for the Big Data Bowl has accuracy to, in theory, to within 0.01 yards every 1/10 of a second. And one of my components of that is 1/10 of a second is really, that's a long time. And having that is not necessarily enough, but it maybe they have more and they just give out that. Is one of the things. So,
yeah, I mean, that's, you know, and sometimes, you know, we've seen it where that 0.01 yards, you know, if you're thinking, I got to do some quick math on here, like 0.01 yards, a third of an inch. That's still, you know, that third of an inch can matter. You know, when you really think about the difference between, especially if a team sees it on the line, if it's, you know, fourth and one, right? So that's, you know, that's a tough. I think that they may not even be comfortable with that much.
So that's XY coordinate given for one player wearing one sensor in his helmet. So it's
right.
Really, I mean, you know, how do you know where his arms and legs are? I mean, it doesn't give you the whole story. So, it's a tough call, tough thing to get done.
Yeah, we're getting there. It's just it's kind of hard. It's kind of like, you know, I asked my father-in-law one time, like, you know, when do you think we're going to have GPS active golf balls? He's a big golfer, you know, and his thought was, well, why would they do it? You know, when they can, you know, why would Titleist, for example, agree to that when they can just sell a bunch of golf balls? I'm like, someone has to have figured out how to have a, you know, a golf ball that has a GPS sensor in it, right? You know, why haven't we figured it? Maybe, I don't know, maybe it's the flight of the ball. I'm not, you know, and the compression of the ball, you know, can it actually withstand being hit X number of times? I don't know. It's one of those things where you think, oh, shouldn't they have figured that out by now? And it's like, no, they haven't yet. Why not? Well, because it's tougher than it looks.
They already have GPS in casino chips of certain denominations. So if you ever get the big money chips, those have a GPS and they know where they are. And
so, all
remember that. I'll remember that for next time.
Right.
All right. Anyway, fantastic conversation here, Jeff. I really appreciate you coming on. I did want to kind of tie this back to some Baltimore things. Maybe we talk about one really quickly. There's always a debate about the 2000 Ravens defense versus the 76 Steelers defense in terms mm-hmm. of which team kind of had it easier. And there's a lot of factors. The 76 Steelers team certainly had a great run in terms of those nine straight games allowing 28 points. The 2000 Ravens defense doing it in a league where offense was at a higher level. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And the defense had it a little bit tougher on them. Any thoughts on that?
As good as Mel Blunt and his cohorts were in 76, I have to give the edge to the 2000 Ravens for that very reason that you spoke of, which is they were playing much more offensively savvy competition. You're playing much more complicated offenses. The West Coast offense was a thing throughout the league. They were playing run and shoot offenses. And also, let's face it, the caliber of athletes that we had in 2000 were just that much better than 25 years before. Just like the caliber of athletes I think that we have now in the NFL were that much better than 21 years ago. Training has gotten much better. The accuracy of how teams practice, like teams videotape every play of every practice in order to figure out where they have an edge. And when you think about, every little move is dissected by, analysts of offense, defense, coaching staff and all that. There's a lot less that's left to chance these days. And so I have to give the edge to the 2000 Ravens. RIP, they absolutely destroyed my Giants in the Super Bowl, and I haven't forgiven the Ravens for that yet. We were simply one of the speed bumps underneath that steamroller. And you got to give credit to that team and to Marvin Lewis and Brian Billick and everyone on that staff for assembling a team. First of all, assembling a group of personnel that was just out of this world. And then in addition to that, giving them, letting them have free reign and be as great as they could be. They were so well coached and they were so athletic. They're the better defense.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And we loved having you on here, Jeff. Tell folks where they can find your work.
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff_Sharon. And I'm also the managing editor of, as you hear my dog in the background, trying to get out of my office. I'm also the managing editor of a site called Black and Gold Banneret. I actually cover UCF Knights sports here in Orlando, the University of Central Florida. And we've had a couple players come through the Baltimore Ravens organization and around the rest of the NFL as well. So if you follow us there at UCF_Banneret, that's BANNERET. You can follow us there for the latest. If there are any Knight fans in the Baltimore or DMV area, that's where you can find the latest on UCF stuff. We have a podcast and everything. And also you can follow me, of course, like I said, individually at Jeff_Sharon.
I'll make sure I get the article out there. It's really a must read, even though it was written 7 years ago, about the kind of the evolution of the NFL in a lot of ways and the offensive and defensive balance. Actually, it's not really about the offensive and defensive balance as much as the run pass balance. You are a fan of the pass-happy NFL.
Oh, yes. Throw more. The teams don't throw enough. We need more passing in the NFL because it's just so hard to defend, and it's a fun game. It's fun to watch. The NFL, don't ever let anyone tell you that the product that is the NFL right now is less fun today than it was before. It is as fun to watch now as a spectator as it ever has been.
Okay, I would agree with that. I also say that watching the Ravens run the football relentlessly on their opponents is something I have tremendously enjoyed, as much as I've enjoyed all the passing I've seen in past years as well. So we've got a very entertaining game, and I think the game is most entertaining when it's a conflict of style, when you can win with multiple styles, win with multiple offense and defensive styles, and there's argument about that's going on every day and how the game's evolving offensively and defensively.
Yeah, that's what that was the old quote from the late Burt Sugar, styles make fights. that's always the case. Styles make fights in football too. And, you know, we've seen that before. I think back to the first football game that NFL game that I ever watched the whole way through as a kid was Super Bowl 25, the Giants and the Bills, Parcells against Levy and the no huddle and Jim Kelly and all them. And probably to that point, the greatest Super Bowl of all time.
Wide right.
Scott Norwood, because we had two very different contrasting styles meeting on the biggest stage, and that resulted in a legendary game, and that's what got me hooked on the NFL. And I think a lot of other fans, if you go back in time, you think about what was the game that really got me hooked, it was probably a game similar to what you're talking about, Ken, which is between two teams with contrasting styles that created drama. And that's what we enjoy to see. That's what we enjoy watching. It's the ultimate reality television. You have no idea what's going to happen.
Great stuff, Jeff. Thanks so much for coming on. Make sure you visit this article that's posted with this. I know a lot of people get this from their phone. Go to the website for this one. Take a look and see if you can get the link and look at the article. Really worth a listen. Jeff, thanks again for coming on.
Ken, thank you so much for having me. Go Orange.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Nobody builds 5G like Verizon builds 5G, because we're the engineers who built the most reliable network in America. And the more you do with 5G, the more building it right matters. The more your network matters. The more Verizon engineers going the extra mile matters. It's us pushing us. It's Verizon versus Verizon. 5G built right from America's most reliable network. Most reliable based on rankings from RootMetrics second half 2020 U.S. report of 3 mobile networks. Results may vary. Award is not an endorsement.
Winning comes in all shapes and sizes. Every day there's an opportunity for a win, just like scratchers from the Virginia Lottery. Every day grab and go, every day giftable, every day fun. It's where anticipation meets instant gratification, and they're satisfying to scratch no matter the outcome. Like the new Virginia Lottery Scratcher Colossal Cash. It's loaded with $100 to $500 prizes. Now, that's an everyday win. Drive to the nearest Virginia Lottery retail location and pick up a scratcher today. Odds of winning any prize, 1 in 3.21.